I only skip Pesach Micha because it's so interconnected to Pelegesh B'Givah that they can't do one without the other, and they don't want to teach Pelegesh B'Givah. It's just too it's too complicated. It's too many questions of appropriateness and age. I mean, Tanakh was not written for a G-rated audience. It's just not. So we're going to start the story. It's going to take us a while to get through it. And part of its complexity is that there are a lot of details. And the details all interconnect with each other. So we're going to go through it chapter by chapter, piece by piece. And hopefully we'll be able to put the story together. A little bit of a Humpty Dumpty case. But we'll do the best we can with it. So we're starting with the beginning of Perek Yud Tet. My goal for today is to get through, at least in at a reading level, meaning just to understand the story, the first chapter, Perek Yud, and then we'll spend a couple of weeks discussing it, but I want to get through the basic piece of it. Vayihi bayamim ahem umelech ein biYisrael. That's probably the easiest part of the story. So here. No king of Israel. That's our introduction. That's our segue back to or bridge between this story and his previous story of Pelegesh B'Givah. And now the story begins. Vayhi ish Levi gar biarkitei har Ephraim. Certain Levi lived in the hills of Har Ephraim. Vaykachlo isha pilegesh mi Beit Lechem Yehuda, who had a pilegesh from the city of Beit Lechem Yehuda. So before we go any further, let's just understand the background. First of all, there are immediate parallels in language and style to the previous story, namely, who are our key players here? Levi, Har Ephraim.
Be
Har Ephraim, or no? You have Har Ephraim is the same as Har Ephraim.
Okay.
And there's one more variable that connects us to the previous story.
In Melech Yisrael.
In Melech Yisrael, of course. Okay, if we're including that one, then there's another one. In the previous story, where did the Levi come from?
Beit Lechem
Yehuda. And where was he going?
Esau.
Right, and where did he end up? In Har Ephraim. In our instance, the Levi starts in Har Ephraim. His Pilegesh is from Beit Lechem. He will end up in Beit Lechem when he goes running after his Pilegesh, but essentially for now, he is from the Har Ephraim. His Pilegesh is from Beit Lechem. So the two stories share right from the outset, and especially when you look at the end of chapter 18, the beginning of chapter 19, the end of chapter 18 identifies the Levi by name in the previous story, in Pesach Micha. The beginning of chapter 19 just talks about a Levi living in Har Ephraim. Certainly not the same Levi. That's clear. But the connection, the parallel connection, bridges these two stories together. That's number one. Number two, how many different tribes are involved in this introduction?
One,
no?
Three or four.
Prime Yehuda, three.
Three, four, and then there'll be a fourth later. Yeah. Right, the three right now are
Levi,
Ephraim, and Yehuda. And later in the mix, we're going to throw in Binyamin. So right off the bat, this is one pasuk with a cross-reference to three different tribes. That's unique. That's not common. Yeah, Levi, why is a Levi, what is a Levi doing in Har Ephraim? What is Levi doing in Beit Lechem Yehuda, for that matter?
Why wouldn't he be there? They don't have an area for
Levi. That's important to recognize and to understand. The Levium, unlike the other tribes, don't have a single contiguous territory identified as the tribe of Levi. Right? They essentially were given cities throughout the land of Israel. So you'll find Levium everywhere. Levium are essentially a tribe that have placeholders inside every single Shevet in Israel. When we get to the story of of Binyamin and the relationship between Binyamin and this Levi, we'll see what that what the significance is.
Do we know how common concubines were at that time?
Do we know from sources? No. Let's talk about the Pilegish for a moment. In this particular story, it's going to be the relationship between this individual, this Levi, and his Pilegish is going to be very complicated. It's going to be very complex for us. But the institution of the Pilegish per se is not a non-existent phenomenon in Tanakh. It's not a common one. Why do I say it's not common? What's essentially a Pilegish?
A second wife or a third wife?
A mistress.
Right. So they say concubine.
They say concubine. What's a concubine?
Or is not married to her.
Right. So it's a relationship which does not have... Technically, the halachic definition of a Pilegish is a wife without a ketubah.
Right. Like a common law.
Right. The modern equivalent would be a common law relationship. Now, in Tanakh, it's a little more complicated than that, because you often had what was not uncommon in the time period, not necessarily in Tanakh in terms of Jewish persona or individuals mentioned by name in Tanakh, but what was not uncommon was the notion that you had a wife for the purpose of having children, and other relationships that weren't for the purpose of having children, but were for the purpose of having relationships. And so what would be called today in other languages, in Tanakh, had a more formal relationship involved, and therefore was a Pilegish. So in a society that was essentially
polygamous,
it wasn't uncommon to have different wives for different purposes. So you had one for having children, and another one is a Pilegish. We saw this before. We had this a little bit by Yiftach, where he had a wife who was a Zona, was a Pilegish. A Zona or an Isha, it wasn't clear what the relationship was to Yiftach's mother. We had suggested perhaps the idea that he had a wife, didn't have children from her, so took a second wife, not have children, then the first one had children. Like there were this complicated dynamics when it comes to relationships of wives in a time frame in which polygamy was, if not necessarily encouraged, certainly practiced. Go back to the Avot. Right? Go back to the Avot. Abraham marries Hagar for the purpose of having children. At the end of the story, he takes a Pilegish by the name of Keturah and has children from it. So the dynamic is complicated. What the relationship was, but certainly the notion of a Pilegish was a common existing culture phenomenon. Doesn't exist today, certainly. You have, for example, by kings, you had many instances where the kings had wives and Pilegishes. So David HaMelech has both wives and Pilegish. Shlomo HaMelech most famously, because he has 1,000 of them, 300 wives and 700 Pilegish, whatever that means. 1,000 is probably a round number, but or an exaggerated number.
But nonetheless... If this guy has his Pilegish, can you assume he has a wife?
Oh. So that's why I said in this particular case, it gets more complicated. Because I'm not 100% convinced, and I'm assuming neither will we be, by the time we read this chapter, that she is in fact a Pilegish. The question of what the relationship is between him and her is going to be the subtext of this parak. What is the dynamic of the relationship? Is she a Pilegish or is she an Isha? I leave that as an open question. We'll come back to it.
But in biblical times, could you have a Pilegish and not be married?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. If you had a relationship without a ketubah.
Oh, okay. Right.
Sure.
I'm curious about that.
Sure. If you just...
So you can't assume anything by this sentence.
You can't assume anything by this sentence other than the fact that it doesn't bode well, because most stories of Pilegishes by themselves are not necessarily complementary. In other words, the Tanakh doesn't encourage polygamy and it doesn't encourage the phenomenon of Pilegish. It just doesn't prohibit it. So even by the Avot, they were essentially monogamous, except for the fact that Avraham ran into the issue of having children, Yaakov ran into the clutches of a Lavan, right? But essentially their intention was always to be monogamous. And Yitzchak, he had neither problem, right, was monogamous. We have no other wives of the in relation to Yitzchak. So, and neither do we have any indication that any of the Shvatim had more than one wife. So there's the notion of a Pelegish, while it exists and it's not prohibited, because at that time period it was very common, not prohibited, it certainly wasn't something which was encouraged. Later, many years later, it was banned. But
so what was Yaakov's relationship with the other two women?
Bilhah and Zilpah?
Yeah.
Also complicated. Because in one place it calls them his wives, and in the other place it calls them his Pelegish. When Reuven goes and sleeps with Bilhah, it says Reuven, or takes Bilhah, whatever it was that he did with her, it says, Vayelech Reuven vayishkav et Bilhah Pelegish Aviv. Unclear, because Yaakov considers them his wives, the children consider them a Pelegish. That's exactly, in the context of the story of Yaakov, it's part of the complexity of how to define the relationship to Bilhah and Zilpah. Is the Pelegish the purpose of having children? Is the Pelegish the purpose of having relations without having children? Is it just a different type of marriage relationship that's undefined? We don't really have definitive answers, and certainly any of these options are probably understandable within the context of the story. It may give us a different dynamic, but in this particular case, beyond the question of what the relationship is to a Pelegish in general, the question in our case is, what's the relationship between this Levi and his Pelegish? And that is where life gets really complicated. Because the first thing we know about this Pelegish is Vatizne Alav Pelegsho. First thing we're told about this Pelegish is that she is unfaithful to him. Batizne alav pilagsho. Znut, unfaithfulness, whatever
that term
means.
Yeah. Does that mean that she may have left him and that in itself could be faithless? We don't really know.
We don't know. And we're going to see that in a moment in the context of the next part of the verse. But before that, the other piece that I forgot to mention, Pasuk Aleph, is the other piece we know about this Pelegish. Is that, where is she from?
Bet Lechem.
So she comes from Shevet Yehudah, he comes from Shevet Levi. Bear that in mind. Not the first time we have seen marriages between individuals of different tribes. Last time we saw a marriage relationship between two people of different tribes was Sefer Shoftim. Last time we encountered a story which highlighted the fact that each of the partners were from different tribes.
Shimshon
and correct, Shimshon and
Shimshon and his.
No, Shimshon is one. Good, and the other.
What about his parents? Wasn't one.
Yiftach. By Yiftach, right? And by Yiftach, it was actually part of the dynamic of the story, because Yiftach is an exile, and why is he in exile? Because one pasuk says that his father married a zona, and the other pasuk says his father married an isha acheret, which either means a zona or a second wife, depending on who's looking at it. Right? From his perspective, it could have been a second wife. From his children's perspective, it was a zona. So in the end, and she was certainly from, right? So the Radak says isha acheret, from a different tribe. Why was she called a zona? Because the children weren't particularly happy that his father married somebody from a different tribe. It's a complicated time frame. And part of the issue that we've addressed many times is the fact that each tribe saw itself as a separate national entity, separate identity. The concept of a united national identity as B'nai Yisrael rather than tribal affiliation hasn't yet been forged. Right? So everybody's identified by their tribe and not necessarily by their status as Israelite.
Well, maybe trying to explain, that's why they start off these stories, Ein Melech B'Yisrael.
And that's essentially what we said last week, is that that's part of the issue in this whole period of time, is that you've got a disintegration of a sense of unity, and the Malchus is essentially the core difference in the Malchus and Shofet is the unification under one flag. That we did talk about last class. We're going to come back to that at the end of the Sefer as well. Be that as it may, but Tizneh Lav Pilagsho, she is unfaithful to him. So Gemara has a machloket as to what that means. One opinion in the Gemara says that she was literally unfaithful. Lashon Znut. And the other opinion is that says Zvuv Matzaba. He found a fly in his soup. So he considered that unfaithfulness throughout. Ultimately, the question is, what's the dynamic of the relationship between this guy, this Levi, and his Pilegesh, and how he treats her? But
so there's a big difference.
There's a huge difference.
She left of her own
volition. Well, she leaves. Well, she leaves.
No,
that's
but,
true.
But whether, if she left by her own volition or if he threw her out.
Well, whatever it is, you're correct.
Right?
Correct. I mean, Vatelech me'ito, it says Vatelech me'ito, she left him. So ultimately, either he made his life he made her life miserable, or he threw her out, or the other possibility is that Vatiznela Pilaksho doesn't mean that she was actually unfaithful to him, but that she left him, and that was considered the act of znut. That one is the introduction to the phrase, introductory phrase to the other. Vatiznela Pilaksho, how? Vatelech.
Because she left.
Vatelech me'ito. So any of the above, we have no way of proving, and certainly no way of knowing what actually transpired in behind closed doors as far as her behavior goes. His behavior is quite clear and in your face.
Can we infer from this that when he says that he took a pilagesh, that it may not have, that it wasn't with her consent?
No.
We can't.
No. That for sure I wouldn't tell you. If it wasn't with her consent, then that would be a whole different category.
Okay.
Definitely not be a pilagish. Vatelech me'ito el beit aviha el beit lechem Yehuda vatehisham arba'a chodashim. She left him. She went back to her father, beit lechem, in Shevet Yehuda, and there she remained.
4 months.
She sat. She lived. She was in hiding, unclear. But there she sat for 4 months. Vayakum isha. Now this word, you need to know the grammar. This is very important. Vayakum isha. What's the isha?
The pilegesh?
No.
No, her
careful.
Husband.
Careful. That's why I said you have to look at the grammar. Okay, this isha.
Oh. So
right.
Her husband got
up. Yeah. Well, her man. So it could be her husband, or it could be what's the male partner to a concubine called? Right? Is it called a husband or called an ish? It's unclear. But in biblical Hebrew, there are two different words here. Isha is right, ish v'isha. Isha with a yud. And a kamatz, and then a mapik hay in the end. It's a different word altogether. It's the equivalent of?
A ishala.
A ishala, her husband. Or her
man.
Or whoever you want to define it. But vayakum isha. Vayelech achadeha. He goes?
After.
Lidaber al liba lahashiva. To speak to her heart. To woo her back. Beautiful. He regrets, he has remorse. He comes back, tries to convince her to come back to him. V'naroimo, v'tzemad chamorim, he's got his nar with him, which who will play prominently in the story in a few minutes. V'tzemad chamorim, and a pair of donkeys. So he comes equipped to her house. V'tvieyu beit avia, she brings him to her father's house. Her father sees him, and he's rejoiced to see him. He's happy to see him. He goes running after him. His father-in-law, the father of the girl, embraces him, and he encourages him to stay with him for 3 days. So I come back to the question of what the relationship is. Come back to the question of what her relationship is. Now, choten is a father-in-law.
Yeah.
It's very hard to define a choten as a father of a pilagesh. Because a chotem by definition comes from the word chatan, or chatuna, marriage. So that to describe her as a pilegish on the one hand, and then to describe her father-in-law as chotno, is very complicated. So we have right in built into the text of the story huge question mark as to exactly what her status was in an objective context and in the context of how he perceives her.
You mean right? the husband?
In other words, if she's his wife, then why does it call her his pilegish?
Right. And if she's not his wife, why do they call the father?
A father-in-law. So I suspect, and I have no proof to this other than the ambiguity of the text, but I suspect that she's probably, in her mind and in her father's mind, an Isha, right? If marriage hadn't yet been so formalized as the way we have it today. You don't have officiating rabbis, and you don't have a chuppah kiddush, right? Yep. Some sort of formality to the relationship. So she probably understood that as being...
She was married.
Married, and he probably saw it as a pilagesh. And the nature of that relationship is unclear. Right? As is the whole concept of what's a common law relationship today. Does it have legal status or doesn't have legal status? There are places where it has legal status and places where it doesn't. Yeah. Even in halacha, it's not clear that a common law relationship doesn't need a get if they break up. Because if they're living together, then there's a certain assumption that they're living together as husband and wife, then that could possibly require a get if they break up. So it's unclear even in halacha whether a common law relationship is considered, in fact, a formal relationship or not. Certainly, I think in this time frame, that would have been not uncommon. So her father embraces him, sees the slave as his son-in-law. The wife, this Pilegesh, certainly had assumed that the relationship is stronger than just that of a Pilegesh. And Vatiznela Pilegesho, whatever that means, I have a tendency to read this story biased towards her perspective over his, but that's just because of the way it ends. So we tend to identify more sympathy with the victim in these cases. Be that as it may, vayochlu, vayishtu, vayalinu sham. He ate, he drank, he slept there, he stayed there, he spent 3 days in the hospitable embrace of his father-in-law. Vahi bayom ha-revi'i, fourth day, vayashkimu baboker, vayakom lalechet. Fourth day, they're ready to go. They get up. It's time to move, time to go home. Vayomer avia na'ara el chatano. The father said to his son-in-law, the second time so referenced, sa'ad libcha pat lechem, yechar telech. Have a little bit of food. Stay. Making a big meal, making a big brunch. Stay for brunch, and then you'll go. So, vayishvu, vayachlu shnehem yachdav, vayishtu, they sat, they ate, they drank. Okay, it's time to go. Vayom ravia nara la'ish sho'elna vilin pitav libecha. Then the father said to the man, oh, wait a second, we just ate brunch, but they ate, and they drank, and they schmoozed, and they siestered, and then they ate, and they drank. By the time they finished the meal, it was already getting later in the day. So the father-in-law said, no, stay another day.
Must have been winter.
Dark out.
Man wanted to go. And the father-in-law begged him, beseeched him, no, stay. So, okay, stayed another night. Do you get the impression that this father-in-law doesn't want to let the son-in-law out of his sight?
Yeah. There's an ulterior motive.
Why?
Right? That's a good question. Why? Vayashkim b'moker b'yom ha-chamishi. Now it's already the fifth day. So by the fifth day he gets up to go. Vayomer avi ha-na'ara, tries the trick a second time. Says the father, Sa'adna levavcha, v'itmamu ad netot hayom. why don't you stay for that? Then it was dinner. Now it's breakfast. Sadna, then wait a little bit. You know, when you have to go so early in the morning, wait till it's the middle of the day. It'll be light outside. It'll be nicer. It'll be warmer. Vayachlu shnehem. They had lunch. They had breakfast. They had lunch. Vayakom ha'ish ha'il alechet hu ufi lagsho v'na'aro. Now the man gets up to go. He, together with his pilegesh and the na'ar. But notice back the return to the reference of the pilegesh. How can you leave now? It's like afternoon. It's going to get dark soon. Linuna, stay the night. Hine chanot hayom, the day setting. Lin po v'itav levecha. And then tomorrow v'ishkamtem machal ledarkechem v'alachta lo alecha. Then tomorrow, and you can get up early, and he'll have the whole day to travel. So by this time already, this is already the second time he's tried this trick. Stay, eat a little bit, and then you know you'll go, and you can't leave in the afternoon because it's going to get dark soon. Stay another night. By this point, the Levi is unconvinced and very suspicious. V'lo ava ish lalun, absolutely refused to stay. V'yakom v'yelech, got up. And he went, Vayavo ad nochach Yevus, Yerushalayim. Got to the city of Yevus, which is the ancient name of the city of Yerushalayim. I'll show all this to you in a map momentarily. He arrives at the city of Yevus, but he's traveling with an entourage. Who's his entourage? So here's his entourage. Who's his entourage? V'imo, tzemed chamurim chavushim ufilagsho. Imo. His two donkeys and his pilagish.
What happened to the nar?
Yeah.
And the nar. Well, the nar is there too. The nar is
not mentioned.
Yeah, it would be inappropriate to mention the nar together with a pair of donkeys. That would be like disrespectful to the nar.
But it's okay. But he puts the
donkey and the pilagish together?
Clearly. Clearly. And I rest my case. We haven't begun to see the depths of the depravity of the story.
Imagine the chamorim first.
Priorities.
But he puts in the same breath, right? I mean,
priorities. Absolutely. Now, let's just do a quick map study before we move any further. Okay. Take one and pass those down. Just to give you a bit of a picture of what's where in this story.
I am.
There's two sides to this map.
I still need one. Sorry.
There's two sides to this map. The side that we're looking at is the side that says at the very top of it, Har Ephraim. So right across the top here. Shoftim Yutet.
Mm-hmm.
Very top it says Shoftim Yutet.
Yeah.
Okay, the other side says Shoftim Chafalot. We'll come back to that in a couple of weeks. Shoftim Yutet. So at the very top you have Shiloh. Near the top you have Shiloh. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then you have that Mesilah that goes down from Shiloh. Remember we mentioned the other week that there's a pasuk that describes Shiloh as being just east of the Mesilah that goes up from Beit Lechem. Or from Beit El. Right, the road that goes up from Beit El. So if you look down that road, that's the main road that comes through the center of the mountains, and you go all the way to the bottom, you'll see Beit Lechem.
Mm-hmm.
Or two-thirds of the way down, you'll see Beit Lechem.
And Yevus is above it.
Okay. Now, Yevus, now go from Beit Lechem straight north, mm-hmm. along that road. First city you come to is Yevus. The next city you come to is
Giv'ah.
And after that, Geva. So Shiloh, whether Geva and Giva is the same place, but Giva is where our story takes place. Geva is where Chazal identified Pesach Micha as having taken place. Geva Binyamin. And there, from there, you go up to Beit El, correct?
Mm-hmm.
And a little further north, you get to Shiloh. So as we talked about the proximity between Geva, or between Pesach Micha and Shiloh, right, on this map, that would put it at 4, 8, 12, maybe 20 kilometers. Right, and this map, maybe 20 kilometers.
On the left of Givat says Shoefat.
Mm-hmm. Is that where Shoefat is today? I'm not sure.
Shoefat's right behind the Har Tzofim.
It could be where Shoefat is today. I don't know. And it's very possible. Because, because if you look at Yavuz, where Yavuz is on the map,
When
Yavuz is on the map, that's today Yerushalayim.
Mm-hmm.
Beit Lechem is just south of Yerushalayim, of modern Yerushalayim.
Mm-hmm.
And where it says Haramah, you see the city of Haramah? Haramah, just north of Giv'ah,
mm-hmm.
Haramah is the hometown of Shmuel.
Oh.
Anybody ever been to Nebi Samuel?
Yeah, I walked there from Har Tzofim.
Right, you can walk there from Har Tzofim. Nebi Samuel is the burial place of, supposed to be the burial place of Shmuel HaNavi, it's not clear, but that's essentially the area of Haramah. So whereas on this map there are three different cities, today Yerushalayim is so big that it's expounded in its southern boundary up to Beit Lechem and its northern boundary up to or near Ramah. We're just south of it. So that's essentially what Yerushalayim is today. In those days, Yerushalayim wasn't a city that was built up. It was a stronghold called the fortress of Yavuz. Or Yavuz was the Jebusites who lived in the ancient city of Yerushalayim. So that's your story here. You're going from Har Ephraim, Yarkatei Har Ephraim, which is where the Levi lived, near Shiloh, down to Beit Lechem. And his return journey is going to take him back along the same road, from Beit Lechem up to Shiloh, or the area of Yarkatei Har Ephraim. The problem here is that he gets to Yavuz. Yavuz, which is the city of Yerushalayim, we'll see now what happens when he gets to Yavuz. But that's where this story is. Along this road is where the story is taking place.
Now, Yavuz would have been part of what was then territory of Yehuda?
Yavuz is the border between Yehuda and Binyamin. Yerushalayim was always the border town between the two tribes of Yehuda and Binyamin, which also plays a role in the neglect of Yerushalayim. Remember that Yerushalayim is conquered twice and abandoned twice. They conquer it in the days of Yehoshua, they conquer it in the days of Shoftim, and in both times, they get to Yerushalayim, conquer it, and move on. They never settle it. The Canaanites return to it. Because it's a border town between Yehuda and Yerushalayim, and Binyamin, so it's sort of
fringe.
No man's land. It's unclaimed territory. Yehuda basically says,
you can have it.
You can have it. Binyamin says,
you can have it.
In the end, it's one of the reasons why Dafka, Yerushalayim, was chosen by David HaMelech.
Because it wasn't in anybody's territory?
Not only because it wasn't in anybody's territory and therefore had to be conquered, it was no land's end, it wasn't identified yet with any particular tribe. But remember that David comes to the throne after a very lengthy, difficult, and complex civil war between essentially the followers of David and the followers of Shaul. At the story of Shaul's fall and David's rise is not just that the Navi comes and says to David, okay, you're going to be the king instead of Shaul. When Shaul goes out to war with David, their forces, their followers, are now going to spend the rest of Sefer Shmuel Aleph fighting each other in a war. From Shmuel Aleph, Perigid Zayin Yudchet, after the story of Goliath, there's a civil war between them. Till Shaul's death in Har Gilboa, at the end of Sefer Shmuel Aleph. It's years of civil war. The first thing that they do when they come to David HaMelech is they ask David to unite the kingdom, to unite the flag. Shaul is from Shevet Binyamin. David is from Shevet Yehuda. David, prior to Shaul's death, he put the capital of his kingdom in Hebron, because Hebron was the capital city of the tribe of Yehuda. So when he needs to unite the kingdom, what does he do? You need to unite two warring factions that have claimed to the throne, and you want to bring them together into one flag. What's the natural thing to do?
Pick a neutral site that brings
together the two tribes. You create Yerushalayim, and Yerushalayim was chosen Dafka because it's the border city between Yehuda and Binyamin. And by creating the capital and the border between the two kingdoms, essentially guarantees that the two tribes of Yehuda and Benjamin will never be able to separate. Because if they separate, you divide the capital. And many, many years later, when post Shlomo Melech, when the capital, when the kingdom does split, Binyamin stays with Yehuda. And it splits between north of Binyamin, which is Ephraim. Binyamin belongs to the rest of the tribes of Israel. Why would Binyamin separate from Ephraim and Manasseh? Think about the split of the kingdom. Why on earth would Binyamin have stayed with Yehuda when Binyamin belonged to Rachel? She would have stayed with Ephraim and Manasseh. And the answer is more about Yerushalayim than about Binyamin. It's about the understanding that Yerushalayim, in the place of the Beit HaMikdash, was held together because of the unity between the two tribes of Yehuda and Binyamin. And that was intentional. That was part of David HaMelech's plan. So that's a very important lesson about the role of Yerushalayim. Actually, it connects to a much more contemporary issue, which is the role of Yerushalayim today versus the role of Yerushalayim pre-67. If you think about what Yerushalayim was pre-67, as a border town, as a border city, as a capital in the border between enemy territory, it was completely neglected. All official conduct of state was in Tel Aviv, because, except for the Knesset, which was a formality, because really, it was too dangerous. It was sitting on the border. It wasn't until post-67 when Yerushalayim lost its status, thank God, as the border city. It was now in the center of the country again that Yerushalayim begins to grow. Complicated piece. But all right, let's go back to...
Can I just ask one question? Is there any significance why Yerushalayim is written here without the yod at the end?
Yerushalayim is written without a yod throughout Tanakh.
Okay.
With the exception of 10 places in Tanakh, Yerushalayim, in all of its close to 900 references, is always written without a second yod.
Okay.
So the question really is the other way around. Why are those 10 places written with a yod?
Okay.
So there's a medrash about those 10 places. But Yerushalayim in Tanakh is written Yerushalayim.
Okay.
Which goes back to the story of Melchizedek, Melech Shalem, who comes out to greet Abraham with Lechem V'Yayin, and the Medrash associates Melchizedek Melech Shalem as the king of Yerushalayim. And they ask the question, how did Shalem come to Yerushalayim? The answer is that the biblical name for Yerushalayim was Yerushalayim. Hence, in English, it's
Jerusalem.
Because right? It's Yerushalayim in its original, probably its original form. Neither does it may. Okay, where are we?
Yud Aleph.
Heim im Yevus, they arrive at Yevus, v'hayom rad ma'od, this day is setting, the day is going away. They left in the afternoon. So by the time you get from Beit Lechem to Yevus, it's only a small part of the journey, but it's already nightfall. V'hayomer ha'na'ar el Adonav, so the na'ar says to his master, l'chana v'nasura al ir ha'yevus yuzot v'nalimba. Let's go into this Yevus city, so we can go to sleep. We're not going to sleep on the road. It's too dangerous. We need to have a place to sleep. So let's go into Yevus, where they will give us a place to sleep. Vayomer elav Adonav, so the Levi says to him, Lo nasur el ir nochri, asher lo mibnei Yisrael heina. Yevus is a foreign city. It's Canaanite, it's Jebusite, it's Amorite. It does not belong to us. The inhabitants are not of our brethren. We are not going to sleep in a city that is lo mibnei Yisrael. V'yavano ad Giv'a. So let's go a little further, and we'll come to the city of Giv'a, which is a Jewish city. It's the capital of the area of Binyamin. V'yomer le'na'aro l'chav nikrava be'achat ha'mekomot. V'lanu b'giv'a o b'rama. So let's go a little further, and we'll come to one of the cities coming up, either Giv'a or Rama. One of the two cities on the north of Yerushalayim. Vayavru, vayalechu, they went, they continued, they got to these two cities. Vatavo lehem ha-shemesh etzel ha-giv'a, asher le-binyamin. By the time they get to Giv'a of Binyamin, the sun is setting. Now they have to stay. Vayasuru sham lavo lalum b'giv'a. They turned to Giv'a, city of Binyamin, and there to sleep. Vayavo vayeshev b'rachov ha'ir. They went, they sat, and they sat in the main center street of the city. They slept in the streets. Why do they sleep in the streets? V'ein ish me'asef otam abayta lalun. Because nobody opened their door to give them a place to sleep. Nobody turned to them and said, "My dear sir, what are you doing here? Who are you? Where are you from? Can I help you? What would you like? Would you like a place to sleep? Would you like a place to..." No, nothing. Zero. They're in the middle of the street. In the city that was inhabited by Bnei Yisrael. Why did they go to Giva? Because it was Achenu, it was from Bnei Yisrael. They didn't want to go to Yevus, which is a city of strangers, of Canaanites. So they went to Giva Binyamin. And the doors remained
shut
and barricaded. V'hine ish zaken ba min ma'aseu min asadeh ba'erev. An old man came from the field. V'ish mehar Ephraim. This old man who came from the field happened to be that he was from Har Ephraim. V'ugar ba'giva. He just lived in Giva. V'anshei ha'makom b'nei yemini. But the local residents were from Shevet Binyamin. What relevance is that introduction?
That the tribes were so split up.
Right. This old man came in from the field. He sees this person standing there in the middle of the field, in the middle of the street, with his pilagesh and his nar and his, and he opens his home. Why? Because he's from Ephraim. They're from Binyamin. So the local Binyaminites, they close their doors. This guy opens his home to them. He's from Har Ephraim. So it's unclear whether he's hospitable to them because he's from the same tribe, or whether in Har Ephraim they were a little bit more open to hospitality than they were in Binyamin. Read Pesel Micha and the bed and breakfast that he set up. Maybe in Har Ephraim they were a little bit more hospitable. Unclear. Vayisa enough. Vayar et ha'ish ha'oreach b'rechov ha'ir. Lifts up his eyes, he walks to the streets, and he sees an oreach, a guest, in the middle of the street. Vayomer ha'ish ha'zaken, anna telech, u'me'ayin tavo. That's which I would have expected anybody to say. Where are you coming from, and where are you going? Who are you? Vayomer elav, ovrim anachnu mi'bed lechem Yehuda ad yarkatei har Ephraim. We're going from Beit Lechem Yehuda to Yarkatei Har Ephraim. Misham Anochi, I'm from Har Ephraim. Ve'elech ad Beit Lechem Yehuda, I had come from a journey all the way down to Beit Lechem. Ve'et Beit Hashem ani holech, I'm going to Beit Hashem. Either reference to Shiloh, I hope it's a reference to Shiloh. Ve'en ish me'asef oti abaita, and nobody has offered me a place to sleep. Shtuch, and the knife, and turn it. It's not enough to say I'm from Ephraim. I'm coming from my journey from Beit Lechem Yehuda. I'm sitting here in the street because nobody in this town has yet come and said hello. Now, v'gam tevim v'gam mispol yesh l'chamareinu. I've got food for my chamarim, for my donkeys. I don't have to worry. It's not food that I need. I don't have to put anybody out. You don't have to feed me. All I need is a place to sleep. V'gam lechem v'yayin yeshli. I've got bread and wine. Vila amatecha, vila narim avadecha, and to your maidservant, referring, right, your servant and the nar, everybody. Ein machzor kol davar, we're not missing anything. The only thing we're missing is a bed to sleep on. V'yomer ha'ish ha'zaken, shalom lach. The man said, peace be upon you. Rak kol machzorcha alai. Don't worry about your provisions. Come stay in my place, and I will take care of you, including
sleeping.
You, not only sleeping, kol machsorcha, all your provisions. Keep your food for the journey later. You're on me. Rak barachov al talan, but don't sleep in the middle of the street. People look cold, so we're just going to check that the heating's on. The heating is on. So. Rak barachov al talan. Vayavyeu leveto, vayaval lachamorim. Brings him into his house, gives yavul, food, to the donkeys. Vayirchutzu raglehem, wash their feet. Remember the story of Avraham and the Malachim? Vayochlu, vayishtu, they ate, they drank. It's wonderful. Such hospitality. What do you think the people of Binyamin did? Hema.
Sounds like a repeat of the old story.
Oh, that's exactly what it is. That's exactly what it is. We're going to get there. Hinei metivim et libam. They are having a wonderful feast. Vine anshe ha'ir anshe b'nei b'liya'al. The local residents of the city, b'nei b'liya'al. We've seen this word before.
We just saw it last week.
Correct. When we read the story of?
No. David and Goliath?
No.
Mm-mm. Mm-mm. No. The word b'nei b'liya'al appeared. We saw it last week when we read the story of?
Don, the people of Don. No?
Chofni and Pinchas.
Oh.
B'nei Eli. Beginning of Sefer Shmuel. B'nei Eli, Chofni and Pinchas, B'nei B'liya'al lo yadu et Hashem. And I said to you at the time that the phrase lo yadu et Hashem, not to know God, is not a religious indictment, it's a moral indictment in Tanakh. Rak en yirat elokim b'makom hazeh v'haguni al dvar ishti. If there's no Yirat Elokim, they'll kill me. It's a moral indictment. B'nei B'liya'al, Anshe Ha'ir, worthless. Worthless people. Nasabu et Abayit, surrounded the city. Surrounded the house. Mitdabkim al Adalet, pounding on the door. V'yomru el Ha'ish, Baal Habayit, Hazaken Lemor, said to this old man, give us the man who came into your house that we may neda'ehu. Neda'enu, meaning we want to introduce ourselves.
Assault.
We should know who he is.
Yeah.
Right? Or we should know him.
They're going to assault him sexually.
Right. As they say, to know in the biblical term, right?
Mm-hmm.
Have our desire with him. Have our way with him. It's an interesting story. When it comes to the story of Lot, the Pasuk says that they also asked for the two strangers who came to the house, and Rashi on the Pasuk says that they wanted them for Mishkav Zachar. They wanted them for homosexual harassment. And the Mefarshim raised the question, where did Rashi get that from? Why did Rashi, or the Medrash that Rashi quotes, assume that in the case of Lot, that they didn't know the word Malachim, but that the people of Sodom wanted the strangers, they were xenophobic to the max. Why do we assume that they didn't just want to get rid of the guests? Why do we assume that there was a sexual undertone to that story? So the answer, I think, is that there's a parallel between these two stories. And here it's clear that their intention was sexual. Here it's absolutely clear because of the way they're appeased.
But why did they wait until the man took them into the house? I mean, they could have done it beforehand.
They didn't know what they were going to do.
I mean, why didn't they do it before? They didn't let them in their home, and then he takes them in, and then they knock the door and walk.
Yeah, it's a good question. Maybe they were also xenophobic. Maybe it was because of their Sodom-like behavior. Once you get to hospitality to guests, now it's already, you violate the cardinal rule upon which the city is founded. Clear. But the parallel to Sodom is really quite frightening. Vayetze alehem ha'ish bal habayit. So now the ish bal habayit goes out to them. Vayomer alehem says to them, al achai, my brethren, no. Al tereolana, don't do this evil thing. Acharei sheba ha'ish hazeh beti, al tasuot nevala hazot, this man has come under my house, under my roof, under my protection. Do not do this
disgusting,
dastardly, evil act. Hinei biti abetula ufilag sheyu. Here, take my daughter and take his pilagash. Otziana otam, I'll give you them. Anu otam, have your way with them. Vasulahem atov v'enechem, do to them whatever you want. V'la'ish hazeh lo tasu davar. But to this man you may not harm. Lo tasu davar hanevala azot. Or divine of Allah, to this man you may not do this evil thing. He is my guest. He is under my protection.
It's okay to take
you want something?
Pilegesh.
Take his pilegesh. Take my daughter.
But that's okay.
That's okay. Jeez. As far as my guest, he's untouchable. They didn't want to listen. They were going to take no. They were not going to take no for an answer or yes for an answer. They wanted him.
Right.
So what happened? The man, our Levi, took his pilagish, vayotze alehem hachutz, and took chazek ha'ish b'filagsho vayotze alehem hachutz. Took his pilagish and he
went
out. Threw her out. Threw her out.
Yeah. In other words, he was giving them to her to them.
Right. Vayedu ota, they had their way with her. Vayit alelu ba kol alayla ad haboker. They had their way with her, oppressed her, raped her all night long. Vayishalchu akalot hashachar. Came the morning, and they let her go. Vatavo ha'isha lifnot boker. Now, interesting observation. Look at the way the text refers to her every time. It's different. When he took her, vayechazek ha'ish b'filagsho. When she returns home, when he returns to him in the morning, vatavo aisha lifnot boker. The flip back and forth between isha and pilegesh is very telling. Vatipo petach haish asher adonai Hashem ad haor. She fell against the door where her master was until the morning. In other words, when they finally let her go, or she escaped, it's unclear, and she comes back to the house. But she doesn't have the strength to open the door. So she's lying at the doorstep with her hand on the petach. Vayakom Adoneha Baboker. Notice how he is constantly referred to in these two psukim?
Her master.
Her master. Vayakom Adoneha Baboker. Vayiftach daltot abayit. Opens up the doors of the house. Vayetzei lalechet lidarko. Why is he going? Why did he open the door?
He's
ready to go home. Right. He's ready to leave.
Without his wife.
V'ineh ha'isha pilagsho nofelet petach habayit v'yadeh al asaf. And behold, his wife is lying there at the door with her hand against the door frame. This pilagish.
But she's called ha'isha pilagsho.
Ha'isha, there's right, pilagsho. In relation to him, she's his pilagish. Exactly. Now look at his response. Vayomer Elea, Kumi, Vinelcha, get up! It's time to go!
Like nothing happened.
Ve'en one, there's no answer. Vayikachea ala chamor, Vayakama ish vayelach lumkomo. So he picked her up, threw her on the donkey, and went home.
Do we know if she's still alive at this point?
At this point, I assume she is not alive. When it says Ve'en one, I assume it means that she died. But she dies there, lying against the door with her hand on the doorpost. And he says to her, looks at her and says, no, get up! She doesn't answer. She's died. Takes the body, throws it on the chamor, and goes home.
Because of the abuse, you're saying. She died because
right.
of the abuse.
And she died. She abused all night long, mass rape, and she doesn't have the strength to survive the night. Now this Levi's angry. Why is he angry?
Because they killed her.
What?
Because they killed her?
No. Ostensibly he's angry because he killed her, right? I don't think so. Right. I think he's more angry that they didn't give him a place to sleep. It doesn't sound to me like he's particularly saddened by the death of his pilegesh. Be that as it may, vayavo el beito, he gets home. Vayikach et ma'achelet, he took the a machelet is the knife or the
shkita or no?
Yeah, a shkita knife. It's a big sharp knife. Vayechazek b'filagsho, took his pilagish. Vayinatcheha l'atzameha l'shnei masar netachim, and he chopped her into 12 pieces. Why 12 pieces?
The 12 tribes.
And he sent one piece to every tribe of Israel.
Oh.
Now, can you imagine being the mayor of the tribe of Manasseh? And in the post, you get a parcel, you open it up, and it's got a piece. And with a note. With a note. Everybody you saw. What would be a reaction? You don't know any of the story. All you know is you get a piece of this pilegesh. This is unprecedented. Nothing like this has ever happened to Bnei Yisrael since we entered in the land of Israel, since we left Mitzrayim. Simu lachem aleh. Pay attention to this. Utsu, take counsel. Daberu, speak. This can't go sitting down, lying down. This can't go without a reaction, without a response. I'm not going to take this lying down. Speak up. React.
But if he sent it to the 12 tribes, then he also sent it to Binyamin, right?
I think it's a, well.
Or is that a, is that?
No, I don't think he sent it to Binyamin. He probably sent it to, probably sent one to Levi, I guess. Okay. Right, there's always 12. I mean, sorry. That was a pun. That was not intended. But, it's always 12. All right, let's just do three more psukim. Vayetsu kol b'nei Yisrael. All the b'nei Yisrael came out. The reaction was unanimous. The response, immediate. Vatikahel ha'eda ke'ish echad. Unified in their indignation, righteous indignation. Limidan v'ad Be'er Sheva, north to south. V'eretz ha'gilad al Hashem, el v'eretz ha'gilad, and all the Gilad, north, south, and east. They all came. El Hashem ha'mitzpah, with the banner to Mitzpah, in the name of God. V'ayit yatzvu pinot kol ha'am, every corner of the people accounted for. Kol shiftei Yisrael b'kahal am Elokim. All the tribes of Israel, the gathering of the nations, the tribes of the nation of God. Arba me'ot elef ish ragli sholef charev. 400,000 soldiers, drawn swords, ready to go to war to avenge this pilegesh against the people of who perpetrated this horrible crime, namely people of Binyam. That's the background to the story of Pilegesh Begin. Alright, let's do a handful more psukim. We need to understand what the cause for this war was. Vayishmu'u b'nei Binyamin ki alu b'nei Yisrael ha-mitzpah. B'nei Binyamin heard that all of Israel had gathered at Mitzpah to wage war against them. If you turn the map over, you'll see. Do you see in the middle of the second map where it says Yericho? You see right up top of Yam Melech is Yericho. Yes. Left of Yericho, due west is Giv'ah. Mm-hmm. And the north of that is Mitzpah. It's a hill overlooking, that's what Mitzpah means, right? A hilltop, an outlook over the valley of Binyamin and Givah, and from there they gather in order to wage war. Some suggest they get to Shiloh, and Shiloh is the Mitzpah, but either way, for now, let's assume for a moment we get to Mitzpah, just west, northwest of Givah. Somebody speak up. How did this happen? How is it that we received in the mail a 12th of this pilash? It's an unbelievable phrase. The Levi, the murdered woman's husband. Just the perspective is wild. A, suddenly he's her husband. Secondly, suddenly she's
wife.
And she's his wife. And she's
murdered.
She wasn't murdered. He threw her to the wolves and then abandoned her and cut her up.
But then he carved her.
He carved her up. She wasn't murdered. If you present her as murdered, essentially, what are you saying?
That they did it.
Right.
But he did all of it. He threw her out and cut her up.
100%. He's guilty on every front. And who does he put the blame on?
Them.
Vayomar, hagivata shel binyamin bati ani ufilak shilalun. Me and my Pelegesh, we came to the Giva of Binyamin. We came to sleep here. V'yakumu alai balei ha-Giva. These balei ha-Giva, they came, they attacked us. They surrounded us. V'yasobu alai et abayit laila. They surrounded our house through the night. Oti dimu laharog. Me, they wanted to kill. Never said that. Me, they wanted to kill. Vet pilagshi inu v'tamot. And my Pelegesh, they raped and she died.
Which is somewhat accurate,
but leaves out some very critical pieces of information, like the fact that he threw her out.
Correct.
But he never says it. Why on earth should he tell them that piece of information?
It makes him culpable.
Va'ochez b'filakshi. The only thing he admits to the fact is that he tried to rally the call. Va'ochez b'filakshi va'anatcheha va'ashalacheha b'chosdei nachalat Yisrael. I took her and cut her up and sent her to the board to all of Israel. Ki asu zimau nevelah b'Yisrael, because look at the disgusting behavior. Look at the immorality of these people of Benjamin and how they've treated my Pelegesh, my wife.
That doesn't excuse why he cut her up, though.
Cutting her up is the least of the offensive issues in the story.
But that's what he's basing, is that he cut her up because of what they did to her.
Nobody's arguing that he cut her up. Yeah. That's the least of the offenses here.
How can that be excusable for his behavior?
Cutting her up is the least. She's already dead. That's the least of the issues here. The issue here was the way they treated the Pelegesh, the way they treated him, the way they treated her, and the mass rape that ultimately killed her.
He threw her out to them. Like,
right, but he does. Why on earth would he admit to that? The whole point is that he wants to incite them against Binyamin. As I said, he's more angry at Binyamin
because they didn't take him in.
Right. Couldn't care less about the Pelegesh.
It's payback.
Hine kulchem b'nei Yisrael. You, Israel. Havu lachem davar ve'etza alom. Speak up. Take counsel. React. So they united. Ish echad. Look at the unity. Look at the achdus. Look at the sense of camaraderie. Nobody goes home until this thing is done. To Giv'ah, we will go up the Goral. The Goral means with war. The lots that decide how we will go to war.
Does the old man just disappear into the woodwork?
Yes.
We'll never hear from him again. V'lakachnu asara nashim lemaya l'chol shiftei Yisrael. So they took a representative sample, 10 people from each tribe. U'mea le'elef, ve'elef l'ravava. 100 for 1,000, 1,000 for 10,000. A certain proportion will take provisions and food. We will do to Givah as they have done this Nevelah to Israel. They attacked the city, or they surrounded the city, ready to go to war against the city. Ke'ish echad Chaverim, united like friends in the unified focus effort of Israel. The most unified B'nai Israel have been since they left Mitzrayim. Unified in purpose, unified in righteous indignation, unified in anger. They are ready to avenge the mistreatment of the Pelegesh and this poor lady.
All because he wasn't invited in.
Oh, well, not because he wasn't, well, from his perspective, all because he wasn't invited in. From their perspective, they raped her. They mass raped her and killed her. That is not done. Now, there is guilt here, no question. The half of Binyamin who are described as B'nai Bli'al. We're not going to let Binyamin off the hook so fast. They are described as Bnei Ben Eliyahu. Their conduct, the comparison to Sodom, does not bode well for Bnei Binyamin. When you behave like Sodom, we know what happened to Sodom. So everything about the story is just remarkable, but I find the most dramatic phrase in the story, the one that bothers me the most, is Ko Yisrael Ki Ish Echad Chaverim. Why does it bother me the most? It's the only place in Tanakh where the unity of Israel is described as Ki Ish Echad Chaverim. What?
Not even knowing.
Well, not only that, but they're turning against fellow Israelites.
What? No, they're unified to go to war against Binyamin, and they will. They'll go to war against Binyamin, and they'll nearly wipe out Binyamin, and do other skirmishes along the way. But the phrase Ki Ish Echad Chaverim rings in my ear. Why? Its source is here. The phrase comes from here. The only other place that phrase appears, Ki Ish Echad Chaverim, only one other place that phrase appears, describing the unity of Israel, unity in purpose, unity in connection, all the tribes together. Nope. The notion of unity appears at Sinai, but the phrase Chaverim, Ki Ish Echad Chaverim, does not. Only other place the phrase is used.
Creation of Israel? Is that what you said?
Only other place that phrase is used, Ki Ish Echad Chaverim. I'll rephrase it. Same phrase, just reformulate it. Put the word Chaverim first. Chaverim Kol Yisrael.
The dedication of the temple?
You say it every month.
Rosh Chodesh Benching. We did it this past Shabbat.
Chaverim Kol Yisrael. And Amar Amen.
But did they take...
The phrase comes from here. There's only one place source for that phrase. Phrase comes from here.
Against wrong people. And we think that's the association.
It's remarkable. It's a remarkable phrase. In the Birchas HaChodesh benching, we take this phrase as a kind of, what a wonderful unified purpose, declare the new moon together, the Beit Din for all of Israel, Kol Yisrael Chaverim. Its source is the exact opposite. Its source is the unity of Israel for the purpose of
wiping out
Binyamin. So I've always argued that the purpose of including it in Birkat HaChodesh is a kind of tikkun, it's a kind of rectification of the mistake, or the foundation of the unity that is identified as for the worst possible purpose. Right? The goal of which, of course, is to unify for a more altruistic and uplifting goal. And
that's
purpose.
Also like
but nonetheless,
when Pasuk in Yirmiyahu, Lo Nishama Bahare Yehuda, and now they say Oji Shema Bahare Yehuda.
Because in Yirmiyahu it appears twice.
No, but I thought.
But Yirmiyahu himself appears twice.
No, but I'm saying Yirmiyahu, it's sad.
It's both. It's both. Oh, both psukim appear in Yirmiyahu.
Oh, I thought it was the sad
no,
thing.
No, it's Yirmiyahu who it's Yirmiyahu's Nevuah in which he takes the original Nevuah of the Chorban and he transforms it into Oji Shema Bahare Yehuda. That's the same Pasuk. It appears in Yirmiyahu twice. You are correct, but there Yirmiyahu does it.
Ah.
Right. Here, the authors of the texts of the Tfilot, in this case, the Birkas HaChodesh, which is many years
later.
Many years later.
Maybe they use the Yirmiyahu as example. Take a negative and take a positive.
Maybe. Me that is amazing. That's the story. That's the first part of the story of Pelegesh B'Kiva. We haven't discussed the battle. We want to come back to this story a couple of weeks because I want to deal with a couple of pieces of it and discuss them in more detail. And then we will move on with the battle.